Primal Leadership by Daniel Goleman, Richard Boyatzis, and Annie McKee. Continued, Cassette 3, Side 1. The Commanding Style in Action. What does the commanding approach, sometimes called the coercive style, look like in action? With a motto of, "Do it because I say so," such leaders demand immediate compliance with orders, but don't bother explaining the reasons behind them. If subordinates fail to follow their orders unquestioningly, these leaders resort to threats. And rather than delegate authority, they seek tight control of any situation and monitor it studiously. Accordingly, performance feedback, if given at all, invariably focuses on what people did wrong rather than what they did well. In short, it's a classic recipe for dissonance. Not surprisingly, of all the leadership styles, the commanding approach is the least effective in most situations, according to our data. Consider what the style does to an organization's climate. Given that emotional contagion spreads most readily from the top down, an intimidating, cold leader contaminates everyone's mood, and the quality of the overall climate spirals down. And although someone like the coercive hospital CEO might not perceive a connection between his leadership style and the downward direction of patient satisfaction, the links are there. His interactions with nurses and doctors spoil their moods, and they in turn are less able to exhibit the cheery playfulness that lifts the moods of patients and makes all the difference in how patients experience their medical care. By rarely using praise and freely criticizing employees, the commanding leader erodes people's spirits and the pride and satisfaction they take in their work, the very things that motivate most high-performing workers. Accordingly, the style undermines a critical tool that all leaders need, the ability to give people the sense that their job fits into a grand shared mission. Instead, people are left feeling less committed, even alienated from their own jobs, and wondering, how does any of this matter? In spite of its many negative effects, however, coercive leaders thrive the world over in surprisingly large numbers, a legacy of the old command and control hierarchies that typified 20th century businesses. Such organizations adopted a military model of leadership, top-down, I order you, that really was most appropriate to the battlefield. Yet even in today's more modernized military organizations, the commanding style is balanced by other styles in the interests of building commitment, esprit de corps, and teamwork. The medical community offers another example. In America today, many medical organizations face a crisis of leadership, in part because the culture of medicine has favored pace-setting and commanding styles. These styles are, of course, appropriate in, say, the operating or the emergency rooms, but their predominance means that many medical people who rise to positions of leadership have had too few chances to learn a fuller repertoire of styles. In most modern organizations, then, the do-it-because-I-say-so boss has become a dinosaur. As one CEO of a technology company put it, "You can beat people into the ground and make money, but is that company going to last?" When commanding works. Despite its negative inclinations, the command and control style can hold an important place in the EI leader's repertoire when used judiciously. For example, leaders managing a business crisis such as an urgent turnaround can find the commanding style particularly effective, especially at first, to unfreeze useless business habits and shock people into new ways of doing things. Similarly, during a genuine emergency, such as a fire in the building or an approaching hurricane, or when facing a hostile takeover, leaders with a take-control style can help everyone through the tumult. Moreover, when all else has failed, the style sometimes works when dealing with problem employees. One executive in our research used the commanding style artfully when he was brought in as division president to change the direction of a money-losing food company. He began by acting forcefully in his first weeks to signal the changes he meant to engineer. For example, the top management team met regularly in a very formal, rather intimidating conference room and sat in gigantic chairs around a marble-covered table that looked like the deck of the Starship Enterprise from the television show Star Trek, as the new division president put it. The distances between people stifled spontaneous talk, and the meetings themselves were stilted, no one daring to ever rock the boat. In short, the conference room symbolized the lack of dialogue and true collaboration among the senior management team. To signal a shift toward openness, the new president had the room demolished, a clear command-style move, with positive effects. From that moment on, the management team met in an ordinary conference room, where people can actually talk to each other, as the new president put it. He used the same approach regarding a set of very detailed decision-making manuals that specified who had to concur before a management decision was made. The new caveat? No more manuals and endless paper passing. "I want people to talk to each other," the president explained to us. "Anyone who needs to can come to the executive committee meeting to tell us, 'Here's what I'm working on. I need your help and ideas.' I want us to be more of a resource to people than merely a rubber stamp." In sending these messages, the new president was forceful and strong. But his strong tactics worked because he attacked the old culture, not the people. In fact, he made it clear that he valued their talents and abilities. It was their way of doing things that he felt needed to change dramatically. What it takes. Such an effective execution of the commanding style draws on three emotional intelligence competencies: influence, achievement, and initiative. And as with the pace-setting style, self-awareness, emotional self-control, and empathy are crucial to keep the commanding style from going off track. The drive to achieve means a leader exerts forceful direction in the service of getting better results. Initiative, in the commanding style, often takes the form not just of seizing opportunities, but also of employing an unhesitating command tone, issuing orders on the spot, rather than pausing to ponder a course of action. The commanding leader's initiative also shows up as not waiting for situations to drive him, but taking forceful steps to get things done. Perhaps most important in the skillful execution of this style is emotional self-control. This allows the leader to keep his anger and impatience in check, or even to use his anger in an artfully channeled outburst designed to get instant attention and mobilize people to change or get results. When a leader lacks the self-awareness that would enable the required emotional self-control, perhaps the most common failing in leaders who employ this style poorly, the dangers of the commanding style are greatest. Coercive leaders who display not just anger, but also disgust or contempt, can have a devastating emotional impact on their people. Even worse, if a leader's out-of-control outbursts go hand-in-hand with lack of empathy and emotional tone deafness, the style runs amok. The dictatorial leader barks orders, oblivious to the reactions of people on the receiving end. Executing the command style effectively, therefore, requires the leader to be angry with the right person in the right way at the right time and for the right reason, as Aristotle put it. That said, the commanding style should be used only with extreme caution, targeted at situations in which it is absolutely imperative, such as a turnaround or impending hostile takeover. If a leader knows when conditions demand a strong hand at the top and when to drop it, then that skillful firmness can be a tonic. But if the only tool in a leader's kit is a chainsaw, he'll leave an organization in shambles. The SOB paradox. Despite the evidence that unduly commanding or pace-setting bosses create a disastrous dissonance, everyone can name a rude, hard-hitting CEO who, by all appearances, epitomizes the antithesis of resonance, yet seems to reap great business results. If emotional intelligence matters so much, How do we explain those mean-spirited SOBs? First, let's take a closer look at those SOBs. Just because a particular executive is the most visible, is he the person who actually leads the company? A CEO who heads a conglomerate may have no followers to speak of. Rather, it's the division heads who actively lead people and affect profitability most. It's been said that Bill Gates and his company Microsoft run in this kind of fashion. He can be an effective pace setter because his direct reports are technically brilliant, self-motivated, and driven. In turn, his direct reports tend to employ resonant leadership styles within their own divisions, where such a repertoire is a must to foster the teamwork the company depends on for results. Then, there are leaders whose success rests on an illusion, such as a high market capitalization or too drastic restructuring, that hides a ruinous turnover of key people that will cost the company severely in the future. Often, those executives turn out to be ego-driven narcissists who are actually terrible leaders. Take, for example, Al Dunlap, who boasted in his autobiography, Mean Business, that his leadership as CEO of Scott Paper would go down in the annals of American business history as one of the most successful turnarounds ever. Although Dunlap exalted toughness, even meanness, as a tool of leadership while he fired thousands of employees, later analyses saw his cutbacks as too excessive, damaging the company's ability to do business. And his apparent short-term successes, at least in his subsequent position at Sunbeam, seemed due to other tactics. Within 2 years after being fired as CEO of Sunbeam, Dunlap and other executives were indicted by the Securities and Exchange Commission on a charge of orchestrating a fraudulent scheme to create the illusion of a successful restructuring of Sunbeam and facilitate the sale of the company at an inflated price. Leaders with such gargantuan egos typically have a blinder-like fixation on immediate financial goals without any regard for the long-term human or organizational costs of how they achieve those goals. And too often, as with Al Dunlap, the companies they leave behind may show all the signs of steroid abuse, pumped up for an intense period to show high profitability, but at the expense of the long-term human and economic resources essential to sustain those profits. Finally, the boss in question might have one or two highly noticeable weaknesses in EI abilities, while still having enough counterbalancing strengths to be effective. In other words, no leader is perfect, nor does he need to be. Our idealizations of leaders can lead us to set unreasonable standards, wanting them to be paragons of every virtue. When examining the SOB question, we need to consider as well whether the leader has important strengths that counterbalance the caustic behavior, but that might not get as much attention in the business press. In his early days at GE, Jack Welch exhibited a strong hand at the helm as he undertook a radical company turnaround. At that time and in that situation, his firm, top-down style was appropriate. What got less press was how Welch in subsequent years settled into a more clearly EI leadership style, especially in articulating a new vision for the company and mobilizing people to follow it. Clearing away the smoke. In short, it's all too easy for a skeptic to make a specious argument against the utility of EI by telling an anecdote about a rough and tough leader whose business results seem good despite his abrasiveness. Such a naive argument, that great leaders succeed by being mean-spirited and ruthless, or in spite of it, can be made only in the absence of hard data about what kinds of leadership truly get results. A scientific study of leaders begins by clearing away the smoke, leveling the playing field to make systematic comparisons. Such objective methods control the false or transient successes a mean-spirited leader may seem to be able to claim credit for, but which are actually due, say, to the luck of an entire industry's high growth period, or to such short-term maneuvers as cutbacks or fiddling with accounting methods. In a rare spirit of open inquiry, for instance, a trade association of U.S. insurance companies, commissioned a study of the leadership qualities of CEOs and the business performance of the companies they led. A research team tracked the financial results achieved by 19 CEOs of major insurance companies and split them into two groups, outstanding and good, on the basis of measures such as their company's profit and growth. Then, the team conducted intensive interviews to assess the capabilities that distinguished the outstanding CEOs from those who merely did a good enough job. The team evaluated each CEO and also sought candid and confidential evaluations from their direct reports. The singular talent that set the most successful CEOs apart from others turned out to be a critical mass of emotional intelligence competencies. The most successful CEOs spent more time coaching their senior executives, developing them as collaborators, and cultivating personal relationships with them. Of the abilities conspicuously absent in the SOB style leader, of course, high on the list are empathy, artful collaboration, and caring about developing the best in people. Moreover, when the company's CEO exhibited EI strengths, profits and sustained growth were highest, significantly higher than for companies where CEOs lacked those strengths. Who wants to work for an SOB? Another little secret about those SOBs, they drive away talent. The best people in any field, the talented few who contribute greatest business value, simply don't have to put up with the misery perpetuated by a bad boss. And increasingly, they leave for other jobs. The number one reason that people cite for quitting is dissatisfaction with the boss. In a tight labor market, when people have the ability to get an equivalent job easily, those with bad bosses are four times more likely to leave than are those who appreciate the leader they work for. Indeed, interviews with 2 million employees at 700 American companies found that what determines how long employees stay and how productive they are is the quality of their relationship with their immediate boss. People join companies and leave managers, observes Marcus Buckingham of the Gallup Organization, who analyzed the data. The conclusion from the data seems all too clear. The SOB leader must reform or go. The business impact of flexible styles. By expanding their repertoire of leadership abilities, dissonant leaders can indeed reform. Remember that Harvard professor David McClelland found that leaders with strengths and a critical mass of six or more EI leadership abilities were far more effective than peers who lacked such strengths. He also found that various kinds of star leaders fostered resonance from uniquely different sets of leadership competencies. For example, one leader might excel through self-confidence, flexibility, initiative, the drive to achieve, empathy, and a knack for developing the talents of others, whereas another leader's strengths might be in self-awareness, integrity, staying calm under pressure, organizational awareness, influence, and collaboration. Having a larger repertoire of emotional intelligence strengths can make a leader more effective because it means that leader is flexible enough to handle the wide-ranging demands of running an organization. Each style draws on different emotional intelligence abilities. The best leaders are able to use the right approach in the right moment and flip from one to another as needed. People who lack the underlying abilities have a narrowed leadership repertoire, and so we're too often stuck relying on a style that's ill-matched to the challenge of the moment. Consider again that study of 19 CEOs in the American insurance industry. The research, as we saw, found that the most successful companies were led by CEOs with a critical mass of emotional intelligence capabilities, such as the drive to improve, an ability to catalyze change, the capacity for empathy, and a talent for developing other leaders. But that research went one step further. The research team asked key employees what it was like to work at the companies these 19 CEOs led, focusing on areas that directly affected people's ability to do their jobs well, not just how satisfied they were. There was a marked difference between the feel of organizations led by those CEOs whose business results were outstanding and those who had less sterling results. The organizations led by the outstanding CEOs did better on every measure of climate, from clarity in communicating standards to making people feel flexible and free to innovate in getting their jobs done. The high-performing CEOs encouraged workers to feel ownership and responsibility for their work. They set higher performance standards, and they mobilized people to meet more demanding stretch goals. In short, these CEOs created a climate where people felt energized and focused, had pride in their work, loved what they did, and stuck around. Leadership drives performance in organizations of every kind, not just businesses. In the United Kingdom, the government commissioned a study that analyzed leadership styles in 42 schools and discovered the styles that drove students' academic achievement. In 69% of the high-performing schools, the school's headmaster exhibited four or more resonance-building leadership styles as needed. But in two-thirds of the low-performing schools, the head relied on just one or two leadership styles, typically dissonant ones. The hidden link was climate. When school leaders were flexible in their style repertoire, able to take a teacher aside for a one-on-one, or to articulate inspiring goals for the whole group, or to just listen as needed, the climate among teachers was most positive. When the leader's style was rigid, stuck in the command and control mode, teachers were most demoralized. The more of the six styles a leader can deploy, then, the better. Leaders who have mastered four or more, our data suggest, especially the resonance-building styles, foster the very best climate and business performance. Moreover, style switching was used both by seasoned veterans who could explain exactly how and why they led, and by entrepreneurs who claimed they led by gut alone. Consider how such fluid leadership looks in action. Leading with style, the right one at the right time. Joan, the general manager of a major division at a global food and beverage company, was appointed to her job while the division was in deep crisis. It hadn't made its profit targets for 6 years, most recently missing by $50 million. Morale among top management was miserable. Mistrust and resentments were rampant. Joan's directive from above was clear: turn the division around. Joan did so with a nimbleness in switching among styles that we find marks the performance of star leaders. From the start, she realized she had a small window to demonstrate effective leadership and to establish rapport and trust, and that she urgently needed to learn about what wasn't working. During her first week on the job, therefore, she had lunch and dinner meetings one by one with each member of the management team. Joan sought each person's understanding of the current situation from a business and organizational standpoint, but her focus was not so much on how a given manager diagnosed the problems as on getting to know each as a person. Employing the affiliative style, she explored their lives, their dreams, and aspirations. She also stepped into the coaching role, looking for ways she could help each get what they sought for his or her career. For instance, one manager who often received feedback that he was a poor team player confided his worries to her. He felt he was actually a good team member, but was plagued by persistent complaints that he knew he had to dispel if he were to succeed at the company. Recognizing that this was a talented executive and a valuable asset to the company, Joan made an agreement with him to point out ways he undermined his team abilities. She sensed that he could sometimes be abrasive, inadvertently saying something that would anger someone, and she promised she would take him aside after a meeting where she saw this happen to help him get better at recognizing the behavior himself. Joan then followed up these one-on-one meetings with a 3-day off-site meeting for the management team. Her goal was team building so that everyone would own whatever solution emerged for the business problems. Using an initial stance of the Democratic leader, she encouraged everybody to express their frustrations and complaints freely in, as she put it, a kind of cleansing of everything that's wrong. The next day, Joan felt the group was ready to focus on solutions, and she asked each person to propose three specific ideas about what should be done. As Joan clustered the suggestions, a natural consensus emerged about priorities for the business, such as cutting costs. As the group came up with specific action plans for each priority, Joan got the commitment and buy-in she sought. With that vision for the future in place, Joan shifted into the visionary style, assigning accountability for each follow-up step to specific executives and holding them responsible for their accomplishment. For example, the division had been dropping prices on products but getting no increase in volume. One obvious solution was to raise prices a bit. The previous vice president for sales had dithered, letting the problem fester. The new sales vice president now had specific responsibility to adjust the price points to fix the problem. Over the following months, Joan continued to lead mainly with the visionary style, continually articulating the group's new mission in a way that reminded each person of how crucial he or she was to achieving it. Still, especially during the first few weeks when the plan was put in place, Joan felt that the urgency of the business crisis justified an occasional shift into the commanding style should someone fail to meet his or her responsibility. As she put it, "I had to be brutal about this follow-up on what we had to do. It was going to take discipline and focus." 7 months later, when our research team interviewed Joan, the division was $5 million ahead of its yearly profit target, up from lagging $50 million the year before Joan stepped in. It was the first time the division had met its target in 5 years. The right tools for the job. How do you know when to apply which leadership style? The most resonant leaders go beyond a mechanical process of matching their styles to fit a checklist of situations. They are far more fluid. They scan people individually and in groups, reading cues in the moment that tip them to the right leadership need, and they adjust their style on a dime. This means they can apply not just the four surefire resonance-building styles, but also be pace-setters or even exhibit the positive side of the commanding style, with strong, urgent direction as appropriate. But when they lead through these more risky styles, they do so with the requisite dose of self-discipline so that they avoid creating dissonance by acting with anger or impatience, or by giving in to the impulse to attack character. As a result, these leaders not only get performance results, but also build commitment and enthusiasm in those they lead. Given the crucial importance for effective leadership of a wide repertoire of leadership styles, one immediate lesson applies to hiring, promotions, and succession planning. Simply put, when it comes to filling a leadership position, it pays to find someone who has the flexible repertoire of four or more styles that marks the most outstanding leader. Failing that, ask whether the person you're considering for a given leadership slot at least has mastered the specific style or styles that are most obviously salient to your business reality. For example, a leader required for a turnaround needs the skills of a visionary, the ability to articulate a new vision that will drive change. If the position demands emergency steps, such as quick and radical surgery of incompetent people, the person will need to step into the commanding style for the time being, and then step out again. When the business need requires getting consensus from employees, building commitment, or just generating new ideas, the person will need to lead democratically. If what's required is simply guiding a highly competent and self-motivated team, say of lawyers or research pharmacologists, the leader's repertoire should include judicious use of the pace-setting style. Whatever a leader's repertoire of styles today, it can grow wider tomorrow. The key lies in strengthening the underlying emotional intelligence abilities that drive a given style. Leadership is learnable, as we shall see in the next part of this program. The process is not easy. It takes time and, most of all, commitment. But the benefits that flow from leadership with a well-developed emotional intelligence, both for the individual and the organization, make it not only worthwhile, but invigorating. Part 2. Making Leaders. Chapter 6. Becoming a Resonant Leader. The 5 Discoveries. The entire top team of the retail chain was in flux, moving up, down, or out as the company struggled to reinvent itself. Not surprisingly, there was more than the usual amount of intrigue, political jostling, and even subterfuge. And Bill, the human resources manager, was smack in the middle of it, involving himself in every conversation and debate. He made sure he let everyone know what he thought, and thought that he knew, setting himself up as the guy in the know. Some of the top team went along with Bill's highly developed sense of self-importance, humoring him because it served their own purposes. Others just avoided him. Then, at one point in the middle of the transition debacle, the board asked a prominent but coercive executive committee member to step down, an upsetting event for the whole team. Bill responded by analyzing the situation ad nauseam with anyone who would listen. He cast aspersions and spread rumors. When his boss got wind of one of these conversations, he was heard to say ruefully, "Bill is ignorance on fire." Yet neither that boss nor any other member of top management had ever taken Bill aside and offered him an honest assessment of his behavior, something that would have helped him begin to improve. Meanwhile, Bill saw himself as the go-to guy and a respected member of the team. Not knowing how to read his complex environment, let alone manage himself in it, Bill's lack of self-awareness was matched only by his spectacular deficit in political awareness and empathy. How can a high-level leader like Bill be so out of touch with the truth about himself? It's more common than you would imagine. In fact, the higher up the ladder a leader climbs, the less accurate his self-assessment is likely to be. The problem is an acute lack of feedback, as was the case with Bill. Leaders have more trouble than anybody else when it comes to receiving candid feedback, particularly about how they're doing as leaders. More specifically, given the clear contribution of emotional intelligence to outstanding leadership, leaders need to know where they can improve on the EI competencies. Bill's spreading of rumors generated tension in the organization, while his excessive analysis was boring. The result was that people did not take him seriously. The paradox, of course, is that the higher a leader's position in an organization, the more critically the leader needs that very kind of feedback. CEO disease. "I so often feel I'm not getting the truth," the CEO of a European company told us. "I can never put my finger on it because no one is actually lying to me, but I can sense that people are hiding information or camouflaging key facts so I won't notice. They aren't lying, but neither are they telling me everything I need to know. I'm always second-guessing." Unquote. This is a clear case of CEO disease, the information vacuum around a leader created when people withhold important and usually unpleasant information. Why are leaders denied accurate information about vital matters? Sometimes the people who should provide the facts fear the leader's wrath, particularly when the leader's main style is commanding or pace-setting. Anyone delivering bad news to such a leader could be symbolically executed for being the messenger. Some offer the leader only positive information as a way of being a good citizen or team player, or for fear of seeming a blasphemous heretic if they spoke against the party line. Or they may just want to be seen as upbeat, and so they suppress negative facts. Whatever the motives, the result is a leader who has only partial information about what's going on around him. This disease can be epidemic in an organization, not just among CEOs, but also for most high-level leaders. It is fed by the natural instinct to please the boss, resulting in a widespread tendency to give positive feedback and withhold the negative whenever information flows upward. When it comes to leaders receiving helpful feedback specifically about their own performance, the problem worsens. It may take a small act of courage to confront the boss with bad news about the company, but you have to be even braver to let the boss know he's out of touch with how people are feeling or that his inspiring talks fall flat. Of course, many people, not just leaders, complain that they get too little useful performance feedback. But top executives typically get the least reliable information about how they're doing. For instance, an analysis of 177 separate studies that assessed more than 28,000 managers found that feedback on performance became less consistent the higher the manager's position or the more complex the manager's role. The problem is compounded for leaders who are women or belong to a minority. Women, in general, get even less useful feedback on their performance in any position, as a leader or otherwise, than do men. The same is true for members of visible minority groups, whether they be Chinese managers in Malaysia or Sikh executives in London. People deprive their co-workers, whether bosses or subordinates, of honest performance feedback for several reasons, chief of which is that it can be uncomfortable to give such feedback. We're afraid of hurting others' feelings or otherwise upsetting them. Yet, while we tend to keep the truth about how others are actually doing to ourselves, oddly, not just the negatives but also the positives, all of us generally crave that kind of appraisal. Candid evaluations matter deeply in a way that other information does not. Can everyone be better than average? But what about the role of self-assessment in the CEO disease? Without a doubt, a leader's self-awareness and ability to accurately perceive his performance is as important as the feedback he receives from others. Yet therein lies perhaps the most pernicious strain of the illness. While most people tend to overestimate their own abilities to some extent, it's the very poorest performers who exaggerate their abilities the most. This all-too-human foible can have great consequences, not just for leaders, but also for the companies they lead. For instance, a study of CEOs of health services companies by Eric Harter, CEO of Healthcare Partners in Lexington, Kentucky, found that self-awareness of leadership abilities was greatest for CEOs of the best-performing companies and poorest for CEOs of the worst performers. Harter, a CEO with a scholarly bent, went to graduate school to research the qualities that separate the most effective executives in top positions from the least effective. He studied CEOs of health services companies that showed 10 years of positive financial performance, measured by balance sheet results and return on equity, and compared them with their peers at companies with negative financial performance for many of the same 10 years. Focusing on levels of self-awareness, he compared the CEO's own assessments of their performance on 10 leadership abilities with assessments their subordinates made of the leaders on those same abilities, including, for example, self-confidence and empathy. Tellingly, the CEOs from the poorest performing companies gave themselves the highest ratings on 7 of the 10 leadership abilities. But the pattern reversed when it came to how their subordinates rated them. They gave the CEOs low ratings on the very same abilities. On the other hand, subordinates saw the CEOs of the best-performing companies as demonstrating all 10 of these leadership abilities most often. Harter's data fit our own findings on 787 people in positions ranging from low to high levels in a wide variety of organizations. When we analyzed the data by organizational level, a striking effect emerged. High-level executives and managers, compared with those in the lower rungs, were more likely to rate themselves more generously on 20 EI competencies than others rated those leaders on the same competencies. The higher leaders were in an organization, the greater the inflation rate. That is, the number of times they saw themselves as doing better on a competence than did those around them. A result of this misperception was that the gap between how the executives and managers saw themselves and how others saw them was greater for those higher in the organization. Those at the highest levels had the least accurate view of how they acted with others. Clearly, then, seeking honest information on leadership capabilities can be vital to a leader's self-awareness and therefore his growth and effectiveness. So why don't more top leaders solicit and encourage accurate feedback? It isn't because they're monumentally vain or think they're infallible. Our conversations with leaders lead us to believe that it's often because they truly believe that they can't change. So even if they did receive good feedback about how their leadership styles affected the team or organization, and even if they saw the truth of that feedback, in their hearts they wouldn't believe that they could alter the way they've done things for so many years, in many cases for most of their lives. The parallel often appears with the people around the leader. If they believe the leader cannot truly change, then why go through the trouble of offering distasteful and awkward negative feedback? Yet we have seen evidence that points emphatically to the contrary. Old leaders can learn new tricks. Leaders can and do make significant, in some cases life-altering, changes in their styles that ripple into their teams and trigger important changes throughout the entire organization. Nurture over nature. Nick Memkin had been the star at his insurance agency, consistently winning awards for his salesmanship. But when he was made the head of an agency in a new city, with 25 salespeople as direct reports, he wouldn't have won any awards for his leadership abilities. He could see that himself early on, and he knew he couldn't afford to make a mistake. His new agency was ranked in the bottom quartile of sales performance among his company's offices across the United States. When leadership consultants McBear & Company, now the Hay Group, began working with him within a few months of starting his job, feedback from his subordinates revealed that Memkin's success as a salesman had translated into a pace-setting leadership style. He was relying on the same high-pressure drive to improve results that made him so good at sales. But in his new office, it was demotivating his salespeople. Worse yet, when stress increased and deadlines loomed, Memkin slipped into using a commanding style, telling people the sales targets they should have, instead of setting realistic targets together. Meanwhile, the agency's atmosphere was growing increasingly tense. As a first step, Memkin was encouraged to focus on his salespeople's performance rather than on his own. That meant finding ways to help each of his reports develop themselves. In short, to use the coaching and visionary leadership styles. Fortunately, those styles draw on many of the abilities that Memkin already possessed, the same ones that had made him so effective as a salesman, such as empathy, self-management, and inspirational leadership. Now he needed to learn to use them to lead his staff. Over time, he began to seize opportunities for one-on-one coaching sessions with his salespeople, which included ongoing dialogue about goals and performance. He worked at managing his impulse to jump in and take over when he got impatient with a salesperson's work, and he made sure that he balanced criticism with positive reinforcement. Accordingly, he found ways to couch the agency's goals in terms of values and a vision shared by all. 18 months later, there were clear signs of progress. Evaluations from Memkin's subordinates showed that he had shifted his dominant styles from pace-setting and commanding to a coaching style, and he was beginning to develop the visionary style. Moreover, a survey showed that these shifts were paying off. Salespeople reported a dramatic increase in their feelings that rewards were fair and that work was motivating. They also had greater clarity about their priorities, thanks to Memkin's guidance. Within 3 years, as Memkin continued to develop leadership strengths, his agency won the first of two consecutive national awards for growth, one of just eight awarded the 100 agencies nationwide. Mimkin was one of the youngest recipients of the award in the company's history. Within 5 years from the day that he walked into the office as the new manager, the agency had moved from the bottom to the top quartile in productivity. We've seen stories such as Mimkin's again and again. They demonstrate not only that leaders can be made, but also that emotional intelligence can be learned, just as Mimkin was able to learn and apply more resonant leadership styles. Still, the question remains, are some people simply born with certain levels of empathy, or do they learn it? The answer is both. There is a genetic component to emotional intelligence, to be sure, but nurture plays a major role as well. Although people may differ in the initial level of their natural abilities, everyone can learn to improve, no matter where he or she starts out. Sometimes it's just a question of building on skills one already has. For instance, where Mimkin the salesman had been using empathy with his clients for years, Mimkin the boss had the pace-setter's weakness for fixating on what his subordinates did wrong, rather than on what they needed to do better. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.